Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagate. Grand Council 83 has launched a judicial review hoping to be accommodated and consulted on hydro dam projects. The Anishinaabe Nation is calling for a commissioner's inquiry into the deaths of six more teens in Thunder Bay. And also in northwestern Ontario, Lacey's fair racism is alive and well, according to a McMaster University professor who did a study on Aboriginal white relations in the area. And the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada will greet their new president in 2012, Glenn Nolan. The former chief of the Missinaba Cree is the first Aboriginal president of the organization. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. In Regina, there are concerns about how long it took for a man to get help for a friend who was found dead in a lake. CBC reports Lanny Elliott was taking photographs in Wascana Park when she was approached by a man. She told media the man was Aboriginal, older, and appeared disheveled. He wanted help because his friend was in the water. Elliott called 911 for the man, but had a hard time getting more information from him because of his distress. Elliott said she was shocked to learn the man's friend had been in the water for about half an hour, and no one in the park had responded to the man's request for help. Police arrived within 2 minutes of the 911 call. A man was pulled from the water the next day, September 11th. The man has been identified as 47-year-old Darylin Boyd and a member of Pasqua First Nation. Nunavut has released its suicide prevention plan. The plan has been signed by the territorial government, the RCMP, the territory's main land claim body, plus a suicide prevention group. The suicide rate of Inuit youth is 11 times higher than the national average, and over the past year, there have been 23 suicides in the territory. The Canadian Press also reports that the plan calls for teachers to get training to spot at-risk kids, more counselors in remote communities, and for the territory to have some of its own mental health facilities. Forums for the Missing Women Inquiry are in full swing in northern BC. According to CBC News, some speakers at forums are calling for an Amber Alert system on Highway 16, otherwise known as the Highway of Tears. They want swift action when a woman goes missing on that highway. A Morristown band member told the forum in Terrace that when an Aboriginal woman goes missing on Highway 16, RCMP never stop vehicles to look for that woman. The woman also said police officials were more likely to look for illegal fish and animals than missing women. The BC Missing Women Commission of Inquiry is holding informal forums in seven communities along the Highway of Tears. It's been reported that at least 18 women have gone missing or have been murdered on that stretch of highway between Prince George and Prince Rupert, and none of the cases have been solved. If you know someone who attended residential school or you have attended residential school and have not yet applied for the Common Experience payment, then you better apply now. The deadline for a Common Experience or CEP payment applications is September 19th. For more information, call 1-866-879-4913. That number again is 1-866-879-4913, or you can go to the Service Canada's website. The chiefs of Mi'kmaq and Maliseet First Nations of New Brunswick have signed an umbrella agreement with the province and Canada. The agreement established negotiation guidelines for a framework agreement on Aboriginal and treaty rights, self-government, and a consultation framework. Joanna Bernard, co-chair of the Assembly of New Brunswick Chiefs, said in a statement, the agreement provides one way that they can work together to protect and advance the rights of Mi'kmaq and Maliseet in New Brunswick. Hospitals in Saskatoon now provide a new resource for Aboriginal patients. The Star Phoenix reports the hospitals now employ two Aboriginal cultural workers to meet the spiritual needs of patients in the Saskatoon Health Region. The positions are a direct result of recommendations from the region's Aboriginal Health Strategy Report out last spring. The cultural worker positions will be in effect for 1 year and reviewed at the end of the term. The two Aboriginal cultural workers have become fully integrated into the Health Region Spiritual Care Department, and the Spiritual Care Department has 8 other spiritual care workers from various backgrounds. Concerns about the lack of Aboriginal representation in the jury pool in the Thunder Bay area have been validated by the coroner in the Bushy inquest. The inquest came to a halt when the concerns were raised about the lack of representation. The Ontario coroner was looking into the death of Reggie Bushy, who was 15 years old and died while attending school at Dennis Franklin Cromer High School in Thunder Bay in 2007. His body was pulled from the McIntyre River November 1st, 2007. Anishinaabe Nation Deputy Grand Chief Terry Wabu says the organization is now calling for a commissioner's inquiry into other teen deaths in the Thunder Bay area. Since 2000, seven young people have gone missing and then found dead in Thunder Bay. Wabu says the lack of Aboriginal representation on jury rolls is a real issue.
It's a fundamental issue for me, but it also should be a fundamental issue for all First Nations. Because isn't it one of the cornerstones of the Canadian justice system that you're to be tried or be adjudicated by a jury of one's peers? And so when you see a systematic exclusion of First Nations people on juries where there's a significant population of First Nations people, then there's obviously something wrong.
Anishinaabe Nation lawyer Julian Falconer says the seven deaths need looking into.
What is needed here is a commission of inquiry. What is needed is a proper focus on the seven deaths. What is wholly absent is a factual, detailed account that would mollify the concerns. But right now, we're in a vacuum. How do you get 7 years being lost in such a similar circumstances repeatedly? It simply cries out for explanations. So what needs to happen is a proper inquiry.
Currently, former Supreme Court Justice Frank Iacobucci is reviewing First Nation representation on Ontario jury rolls. Grand Council Treaty No. 3 has filed a judicial review on the way Ontario hands out power contracts to Ontario generating dams in the territory. Grand Chief Diane Kelly says the dams are affecting harvesting rights.
Now, the reason the Chiefs of Treaty 3 decided to do that was because there's flooding that occurs within our territory which impacts our harvesting rates, particularly in relation to wild rice and the fisheries.
Kelly says, as a matter of fact, First Nations in the Treaty 3 area have never been consulted on hydro dam projects or any changes to them. She says they would like to see their rights accommodated and be consulted. Kelly says flooding has been happening in their area since dams were put in about 100 years ago. The Grand Council of Treaty 3 will wait for about 1 year before they know if the judicial review has been approved to move forward in court. In British Columbia, the provincial representative for children and youth says the province may have to claw back some of the authority it has delegated to Native agencies for Aboriginal children. The Globe and Mail reports Mary Ellen Trappell-Lafont released a report after a year-long investigation into the death of a four-month-old Aboriginal boy. The Globe says the report reveals a chaotic and inadequate system which failed to protect an infant known to be at high risk. The report indicates that the baby's case was managed by 16 social workers who formed 11 different plans for his protection and in different jurisdictions, First Nations and non. He was initially brought into care because he was known to be at high risk. Trappell also points out in the report that the death of the infant is a disturbing pattern in which the child welfare system for thousands of Aboriginal children is not seamlessly blended with the broader provincial one. A First Nations technology team in BC has won an international award. The multimedia team was recognized for their development of Waterkeeper, an interactive 3D training tool designed to support operators of small community water systems to provide clean and safe drinking water for First Nation communities. The award was given as part of the International Series Play Awards, a program showcasing examples of corporate, military, healthcare, and school and home learning tools. After a water operator is certified in a First Nations community, Waterkeeper provides the operator with an online communication tool and was launched in 2009, and it's available to all communities on either CD or online. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Round and around love. remember that our love will always be the center of our unity. Darling, you're where we belong now. Darling, like the earth around the sun.
Council Treaty No. 3 has launched a judicial review to look into the way the province hands out power contracts to hydro-generating stations in the territory in northern Ontario. Diane Kelly is the Grand Chief of the Grand Council Treaty No. 3.
Grand Council Treaty 3 filed a judicial review application with regard to a decision made by the Minister of Energy as well as the OPA with regard to the HCI program. Now, the reason the Chiefs of Treaty 3 decided to do that was because there's flooding that occurs within our territory which impacts our harvesting rates, particularly in relation to wild rice and the fisheries.
So before these even went in, were First Nations in the area consulted, and what about environmental impact studies?
Well, First Nations were not consulted, and see, that's the part of our claim in the application is because we were not consulted when it came to the development of the program, the HCI program, and we weren't consulted when it came to the selling of these generating stations. And again, when our rights are being impacted, we believe that we should be consulted.
So what would you like to come of this?
Well, what we'd like to see is that, you know, because of the flooding that's occurred in the territory, we've pretty well lost the ability to harvest wild rice, as an example. And, you know, the wild rice has been such an integral part to who we are as Anishinaabe people that we really would like to see our rights accommodated. So we're hoping that through this application that the Ontario government will uphold its duty to consult with our Grand Council and our communities around the impact to our rights. They do have a duty to act honorably.
And so what about any form of compensation to help put wild rice stocks in other areas and fish stocks?
Well, I'm hopeful that we can negotiate. We'll see what happens. I mean, the judicial review application was just filed on September 1st. But, you know, you asked also about environmental impacts. There was a report that was commissioned back in 1981. It's called the Unis Report, and it was commissioned by the Indian Claims Office. And so in that report, it was stated that there could be the same amount of hydroelectricity produced, but with less impact to the lands in terms of the flooding. So we're wondering why that report has never been implemented.
And so how long has the flooding been going on?
The flooding's been going on since the dams were put in, which is probably about 100 years now. But what we believe is because of this HCI program, there's built-in incentives to increase the flooding and also to increase the flooding at certain peak hours.
And so how long has the HCI program been in place?
That you'd have to look at the judicial review application. I'm not sure of the date, but it's not been very long. It's been within the last 2 years.
So I was just going to ask you, so why are you going for the judicial review now?
Well, we're going for the judicial review now because when the HCI program first came out, we weren't aware of the total potential impact to our rights. We weren't aware that Ontario was looking at the sale of the dams. We weren't aware of all of these issues. Now, we have written letters, and they haven't been responded to in an appropriate way. And so in that regard, we feel that we've been very diligent all along in terms of giving the Crown notice that our rights are being impacted.
Do you know how long this process will take?
Well, we filed September 1st, and we're hoping that we could have a decision within about 8 months.
Okay, so it'll take nearly a year. And so that's everything for me. Is there anything you'd like to say or add?
I just think that there's also a recent Kuwaitan decision, Kuwaitan versus MNR, and in that decision, clearly states, even though it's a trial, it clearly states that Treaty 3 has harvesting rights and that the Ontario Crown has a responsibility to ensure that those harvesting rights are not impacted. And so, again, I think that it's a new era in terms of Ontario has to look at their consultation policies and look at the way that business is being done within the Treaty 3 territory. Because we do have those rights, and we do need to have a proper relationship with the Ontario Crown.
That was Diane Kelly, Grand Chief of Grand Council Treaty No. 3. Concerns about the lack of Aboriginal representation in the jury pool in the Thunder Bay area have been validated by the coroner in the Bushy inquest. The inquest came to a halt when the concerns were raised about the lack of representation. The Ontario coroner was looking into the death of Reggie Bushy, who was 15 years old and died while attending school at Dennis Franklin Cromarty High School in Thunder Bay in 2007. His body was pulled from the McIntyre River November 1st. 2007. Anishinaabe Asking Nation Deputy Grand Chief Terry Wabus says the organization is now calling for a commissioner's inquiry into the other teen deaths in Thunder Bay.
Well, firstly, there was a ruling on Friday by Dr. Eden that concluded that the jury role for Thunder Bay was invalid with respect to First Nation, representation on its rolls. And that affected the Bushy inquest, which was to have started in January of 2009. It's taken long for the province of Ontario to come to this conclusion that even though we've been trying to work with them, telling them that this is a problem, and so with today, we didn't specifically talk to with respect to the Bushy inquest, but what we did this morning here at Thunder Bay is call for a commission of inquiry to look at circumstances of the seven First Nations youth from the Nan area that have tragically passed away while attending school here under the same circumstances or under similar circumstances as did Reggie Bushy a number of years ago. So what we're saying is that at the ruling on Friday, the coroner's inquest system obviously is not sufficient to get to the bottom of what the families are trying to find answers to as to what happened, not only in Bushy, but also to the other young people.
Wabus also says the lack of Aboriginal representation is a real issue because a lack of Aboriginal representation means First Nations people aren't facing their peers in courtrooms.
Well, it's a fundamental issue for me, but it also should be a fundamental issue for all First Nations, because isn't it one of the cornerstones of the Canadian justice system that you're to be tried or be adjudicated by a jury of one's peers? And so when you see a systematic exclusion of First people on juries where there's a significant population of First Nations people, then there's obviously something wrong. If you're a non-native person and you live in a community that's 90% non-First Nation, and if you're a native person, then obviously you would want to you'd want a fair representation of your own people. That would be that would understand your circumstances. Knowledgeable about your culture, maybe your language, those types of things. So that's why it's important you would want to have people that at the very least be considered to be on the jury. We don't even have that. More or less having a fair representation of First Nations, and it's already has had its effect under just a recent jury trial here in Thunder Bay was adjourned because of the Ontario Court of Superior Court or Ontario Court of Appeal ruling on our issue. Justice Helen Pierce here in Thunder Bay had to adjourn a murder trial which involved a non-First Nations person because he didn't see any Aboriginal or First Nations people on the prospective jury pool of this particular trial.
Julian Falconer is a lawyer that represented the Anishinaabe Nation for the inquiry into the death of Reggie Bushy. He says since the truth is out about the lack of Aboriginal representation, something can be done about it, and a commissioner's inquiry into the deaths of the 7 other teens that died in Thunder Bay can be looked into.
The reality is that the jury role here is invalid. There has been a systemic exclusion of First Nations for some years. Truth is finally being told about that, and that's important. Certainly Nan wants to see it fixed, but you can't fix something if you don't identify it. Dr. Eden, the coroner on the Bushy case, gave a ruling on Friday, just this past Friday, on the issue. And it's really that final reality that has prompted the executive at Nan to take a leadership position and to call on behalf of all the families and the communities for a commission of inquiry to look at these 7 deaths and to tell the story of these 7 youth and to make sure there's nothing sinister going on, but at the same time to analyze the systemic realities that attach to these deaths.
Falconer also says the lack of Aboriginal representation is not something new in the region.
Well, this actually goes back to March of this year. In March of this year, if you go to Nan's website or falconerattorney.com, you will see that there is a reference to a ruling in the Court of Appeal in the Nan versus Eden case, in which the Court of Appeal recognized that there is a systemic problem. Now, from that Court of Appeal judgment came another ruling in March of this year in Thunder Bay in the case called Wareham, a murder trial that had to be adjourned because of an unrepresentative jury roll. And that same jury roll has been found to be the source of the problem again. So this isn't the first ruling of its kind since March, but certainly all of these are new developments. In August, just last month, a commission of inquiry was appointed with a jury issue. Justice Iacobucci is examining the jury issue because it's obvious now that this is a systemic problem that has implications across the province.
Nan Deputy Grand Chief Wabus agrees with Falconer, plus he says the lack of Aboriginal representation is probably an issue right across the country where there are high populations of Aboriginal people.
Well, I think the precedence that it does set is that if it's a problem in Thunder Bay or it's a problem in the Kenora districts or if it's in an area where there's a large First Nations population, then I think the same would apply. I'm sure if you went to a different area, even, say, nationally, I'm sure it's the same. It would be the same across the country where First Nations are underrepresented on the jury pool.
Wabus would like to see the province respond to Nan's call for a commission's inquiry, as well as take action on the lack of Aboriginal representation on jury rolls.
I would like to see the province act and say yes, we do require a commission of inquiry to get to the bottom of the circumstances to the deaths of these. Of these young people, but as well, at the same time, look at working with the provincial government to rectify the issue of First Nations representation on juries, and that's what we're doing, looking to do proactive manner because we're working with we were also able to get we got an agreement with the province to work with. Former Justice Iacobucci to do a review on the jury roll system. So, So I'd like to see fundamental changes.
Currently, former Supreme Court Justice Frank Iacobucci is reviewing First Nation representation on Ontario jury rolls. And in British Columbia, the province put out a call asking First Nation band leaders to provide names in hopes of boosting the number of Aboriginal people in jury pools. And now before we break, here's a song from Sandy Schofield. It's Time Has Come.
Underground through the concrete contains an infection of sound. Move slow on the prey to ensure the slay. For protection of the next, there's no delay. I got family and friends, so I gotta make ends. No time to sit back, just talk and pretend. Let's drive this train like water through the plains. You slip up, you stay up. If you fall up, then you get. You give up, you screw up. Don't drift off the purpose. I'm the only one mind, but the old one behind. Who tell me to work because life is the grind. These kids these days have shit for the future. The time is now, and nothing ever matters. Gotta give what I can to the struggle and your enemy. Equal, coming from Cree territory.
People all across the world, we can change the planet. Put your fist to the sun and you can grab it. Whatever holds you down, you can break the habit. Open up your eyes wide and you can have it. Or you connect to a call like a real rebel. Today the time has come to take it to the next level. Put your faith in self, revitalize the spirit. Speak to the mind so we can all hear it. These irresistible times, they can make you weak. You got strength and rhymes every time you speak. Read between the lines of this industry. Communicate direct between you and me.
Nuns, my babies, mum, two sons under the moon and sun, protected without guns, funded by ambition, spiritual without religion, fast for visions, dreams are giving will depicted. Give me a minute alone to find the spirit of missing women and free this soul. The time has come, it's about to snow in the summer, heat stroke in the wind, a chemical spell, the earth is under this. Cross the thunder with lightning, teardrops, a medicine man I asked to help make the fear stop. I've been in many weird spots on this planet earth, even damned and cursed birth. This man occurs, work until the hands hurt. It comes with ethnicity like dam and water sources. Comes with electricity like ego check. Should come with a victory. The future should be perfect according to our history.
All the good people, 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 all the good people.
People,
Jeff Dennis is a professor at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He recently presented his dissertation to the community in the Rainy River District. His dissertation was entitled Canadian Apartheid, Boundaries and Bridges in Aboriginal-White Relations. Dennis wanted to assess the general theories of race relations. Well, I'll let him tell you about his dissertation.
The dissertation is looking at the relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal communities, specifically in the Rainy River District of northwestern Ontario. And it was based on 18 months of fieldwork where I lived in the community and participated in community events and volunteer groups. I conducted 160 in-depth interviews and surveys with First Nations, Métis, and non-Aboriginal residents. And I also organized a photo voice project in which a dozen residents were given cameras and asked to take pictures on things that are meaningful in their lives, and then we'd come together as a group and discuss them. So that all occurred over a period of 18 months. I wrote the dissertation, defended it in May of this year, and I was just back in the district last week to present some of the major findings and conclusions and to seek residents' feedback as I prepare to convert the dissertation into a book.
And what were some of those findings?
So one of the most interesting findings to me is the fact that in this district, the residents are so close and yet so far apart. On the one hand, there are many positive things happening, many close relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. There's a long history of intermarriage stemming back to the fur trade. Many people have close friends and extended family members in both groups. The kids all go to the same schools together. People play sports together and do other activities together. And yet there are pervasive prejudiced attitudes toward Aboriginal people. And this seems to violate not only common sense, but one of the most well-known hypotheses in sociology and social psychology, which is known as the contact hypothesis. And that says that the more interaction between groups over time, that should break down stereotypes and reduce prejudice. But that doesn't always seem to happen. It doesn't seem to happen in a lot of cases that I observed in the Rainy River District. And so the question is, why? How is it possible for people to maintain certain forms of racist views, even though their best friend might be Native or they might even be married to a Native person?
And did you explore the why behind that all?
Yeah, so some of the processes that I identified, one of the things that jumped out to me is a process known as subtyping, in which individuals who violate stereotypes are seen as exceptions that prove the rule. So people will say things like, my best friend is Native, but he's not your typical Native. Or we have good Indians in this town. And so the implication of those things is that Indians elsewhere are not so good, or that the typical Native is not someone who's worthy of being a good friend. And so those ways of thinking indirectly reinforce the prejudice that's out there. Another one of the reasons why these racist views persist is the tendency to avoid discussing the issues openly, at least until there's a crisis. It's quite possible for people to have close friendships, to play sports together and participate in other activities together, and yet maintain racist views because they don't talk about things like treaties or the residential school system or some of the systemic and historical factors that are still affecting Aboriginal people today. And so when you ask about people's views on residential school apology or treaty rights, you find extremely different views among the Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal population.
Hmm. And what were your conclusions?
There are a number of conclusions, but I guess the one of the major things that jumps out is that it's really a case of conflicting frames or competing visions of the proper relationship between groups. that exist, even despite the intermarriage and despite the many common interests and positive things that are happening between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal communities, when it comes to basic views about the treaty relationship or understanding of history and how that affects people today, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal residents are still largely living in different worlds. And I think that in terms of some of the practical or policy implications, I don't pretend to have all the answers, but a few of the things that come to mind is that we do need to continue fostering these close forms of contact, and particularly have people meaningfully discuss the issues, that contact is able to overcome the most overt forms of racism and prejudice, but contact alone is not enough, and so you need to have better historical education, historical education that's integrated into the public school curriculum from an early age, I think could go a long way to overcoming some of the laissez-faire racist views. In addition to that, I think the most important thing is to have an ongoing dialogue between communities about what it means to have a treaty relationship, to keep that dialogue going. And I hope that the presentation that I gave last week led to a good hour-long discussion afterwards. People continued to have questions and came up to me afterwards. And I think those discussions are continuing out in the community, so I hope that in some ways this will be a catalyst for getting that dialogue going.
That was McMaster University Professor Jeff Dennis. Now here is Don Amaro with If You Want To from his album Change Your Life.
Hold on, it will be a while, and you'll find yourself in this place. It won't take long for you to see, you gotta go deeper to be set free. If you wanna try and walk this life alone, you'll find yourself far from home. Take my word and you're gonna know that life gets better when you're not alone. You walk the road, but you walk alone. Forget the ones you've always known. There's more to life than broken hearts. You see it clearly, you gotta go back to start. Try and walk this life alone. You'll find yourself far from home. Take my word and you're gonna know that life gets better when you're not alone. Go on. Love.
Talks, Peter Jensen spoke with Glenn Nolan.
I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Glenn Nolan. Glenn is currently the first vice president of the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, and in March 2012 will become the first Aboriginal president of the association. As background, the PDAC is a national association that represents the Canadian mineral exploration and development industry. It hosts the world's largest mineral convention, trade show, and investors exchange annually in March in Toronto. And among its many activities, the PDAC has an Aboriginal Affairs program that promotes greater understanding and cooperation between Aboriginal communities and the mineral industry in Canada. And it encourages increased Aboriginal participation in exploration and mining. Glenn, welcome to Nation Talk.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Glenn, I've got a couple of questions for you. I'm curious to know a little bit about your background and how you got to be where you are today. And then, of course, very interested to learn about your ascension to the presidency, so to speak. Can you give us a few insights?
Well, I'll answer your first question. I started off in the mining industry growing up in mining town. Went to school for geology and geophysics, and started my professional career in the workforce as doing exploration work in northern Canada. Worked with numerous First Nation communities throughout that time, and then I took a different path and started a business in ecotourism, and led numerous trips around northern Ontario before becoming chief of my community, where I realized there was a huge gap between industry and their approach in engaging communities and communities' understanding of the mineral industry. And as the chief, I was knocking on a lot of mining companies' doors, junior exploration companies' doors, that were working in our territory and hadn't approached us yet. And from there, I met a number of people who were members of the Prospectors and Developers Association. I was asked to join a committee, the Aboriginal Affairs Committee, and from there became elected to the Board of Directors and eventually elected as into the executive as second vice president. And when you get elected as second vice president, you hold that term for 2 years, move up to first vice president for 2 years, and then you become president for 2 years, and then you have the honor of being past president for 2 years. So overall, it's an 8-year commitment for the type of work I'm doing with the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada.
Glenn, you touched on a couple of things that I think are probably near and dear to many community hearts, and that's the idea of engagement and partnerships with communities. Do you see that as a focal point of the work of PDAC, and I guess would you like to continue or perhaps make it a focal point of your work when you get in as president?
Well, like every other industry or business or sector of society, changes are always happening. And with the mining sector, exploration, early stage exploration, advanced exploration, development, and then production, and then eventually closure of a project, things have changed since the 60s and 50s. And it's not just about the technical part or the financing of a project. There's environmental concerns that became to the forefront in the 70s and 80s, and now are more entrenched in the psyche of developers. As they start to develop, they have to ensure that environmental concerns are addressed and environmental standards are at the highest level. But the new emerging area is community engagement or corporate responsibility. And I think that is becoming as important as the technical end of the development of a mining project or exploration project is how companies will engage and dialogue with communities. And it's no longer acceptable for companies to come in and tell communities what they're going to do. It's a two-way communication process now. And that's where I see the industry really having to make strides. And the Prospectors and Developers Association is working with our membership to ensure that we have the tools as developers and explorers to engage more proactively and more with more sensitivity and more with more respect with our community partners.
Glenn, if you don't mind, I'd like to look forward a bit. And obviously, it's a huge honor. There's a lot of responsibility that comes with the title of president. Are there any particular goals that you're setting for yourself? I mean, it's obviously a huge association, over 8,000 members, and the association, I believe, will be 80 years old this year, this coming year. What is you'd like to see result from your term as president?
Well, there's some pretty large shoes to fill with past presidents that have really made some significant changes, not only in how our industry is perceived by society in general, but by Aboriginal communities. There's a lot more work that needs to be done, and I think that I'll be positioned to carry on that work with the Inuit specifically and the Métis, various Métis groups across the country who want to participate more equitably in the industry. But also continuing with the First Nations, obviously with my history as a former chief, the kind of role that I've been playing as a liaison between First Nations and the industry, I've been able to share information that has provided, whether it's the company or the community, to understand each other better. But also I'd like to take this knowledge that we gained here in Canada on working with our Aboriginal partners and bring that knowledge to other Indigenous groups around the world.
Glenn, I want to really thank you sincerely for joining us today. It was a real pleasure, and I wish you the best of luck in your new role as president next year. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Peter.
That was Glenn Nolan speaking with Nation Talk's Peter Jensen, and miigwech to Nation Talk for that interview. You've been listening to Bomsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts, and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomsida.